Hillary Clinton, good morning and a happy Independence Day to you.
Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful to talk with you.
You're talking to us from London. You're promoting your book. I suspect that on the 4th of July 2015, you do not expect to be in Britain or anywhere close to it.
Well, one never knows, Sean. Maybe I'll be in Ireland instead.
Well, look, we'll come back to all that. The book is called Hard Choices, and it's almost a hard choice deciding where to start. But let's begin with the moment where President-elect Obama, as he was then, asked you to become Secretary of State. Now, you say that despite all the rumours, despite the hints and the questions, you were still floored by that offer. Why?
Well, because I had no indication from him that he was thinking about it, and I had, of course, heard rumors about everyone, as we often do at the beginning of a new administration, and I had made it very clear I wanted to go back to the Senate to continue representing the state of New York. So it was a surprise to me that he seemed so intent upon persuading me to become Secretary of State.
And you did take some persuasion.
I did, because it was a hard choice for me. I had loved my work in the Senate, and I really felt an obligation to the people of New York. We'd been through some very hard times, starting with 9/11 and going through the financial crisis. I also thought that it would be, difficult to go from one very intense experience, namely the presidential campaign, into Secretary of State, and I wanted a bit of a breather. So for all the reasons that I lay out in the book, I was hesitant about accepting his offer.
Were there still wounds at that point that hadn't been closed as a result of the campaign?
Not between him and me or our families, but I think our supporters on both sides were still somewhat bruised, and it took a while to work through that. I was particularly pleased, however, that upon becoming Secretary of State, I was very welcomed into the White House and working with all of the people that I had been campaigning against some months before.
Did it take long to get over those initial difficulties? And did you, in fact, become quite friendly personally with President Obama by the end of the 4 years?
I did become very friendly, and we did become friends. We came first to partnership and then to friendship. But one of the things that I found upon my very first trip as Secretary of State in February of 2009, when I went to Asia, was that I could use the experience that I'd had with him, campaigning so hard against him, as a way of explaining to people that in a democracy, you have to close ranks and work with each other. I mean, that's part of what sets us apart. In some countries, if you were to campaign against someone, you could get imprisoned or exiled, even killed, not offered the role of Secretary of State. So I used my very fierce electoral rivalry with the president as an example, especially in new and developing democracies, about how two people can come together for the good of the common good.
You say that the decision to go in and get Osama bin Laden was your proudest moment as Secretary of State working with the president. What was going through your head in that now famous photo of you and others watching events unfold live on screen?
Well, it was incredibly tense, Sean. The small group of us were in a room watching a video feed of what was happening on the outside of the compound. And at one point, one of our helicopters miscalculated because of the model it had practiced on what would be required to get over the wall into the courtyard. And in fact, it hit the wall and became disabled. And we all were just holding our breath at that moment. It was such a scary time. And then they go into the compound. We could not see inside the buildings, but then we got word that bin Laden had been killed. And then they had to get out of the compound, get loaded onto the helicopters, get the other helicopter in to substitute for the one that was disabled, and blow up that disabled helicopter. So it was just nonstop stress from the moment it began until, thankfully, they lifted up and got back across the border into Afghanistan.
A less happy outcome or event unfolded on September the 12th in 2012, when the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya, was attacked, and Chris Stevens, your ambassador, and his aide Sean Smith lost their lives. Now, you had earlier welcomed the end of the Gaddafi regime a year before that, but you've been criticised for not doing enough as Secretary of State with others to make that outpost safe on the anniversary of 9/11. What's your response to that criticism? Is it fair?
Well, it's inaccurate. Chapter in my book that goes into great detail about what happened in Benghazi, which was an outpost. It wasn't our embassy. Our embassy was in Tripoli. But it was the center of the beginning of the revolution against Gaddafi, and I actually sent Chris Stevens to Benghazi during the conflict to begin to work with those whom we expected would have positions of influence in any kind of post-Gaddafi Libya. And it was, as many outposts and dangerous places are, very well thought through as to why we needed to be there. And certainly Chris Stevens supported a U.S. presence there, had come over for a brief visit in those days, which unfortunately coincided with the attack, not only on our diplomatic outpost, but on a CIA annex about a mile away. And we had arrangements with armed Libyans to defend the outpost in the event of an attack. They unfortunately did not fulfill their obligations. We also had an understanding with the CIA annex to support any kind of problem at the mission. And it was a tragic, terrible situation in a dangerous part of the world where the U.S. Has to be present. Retreat is not in our DNA, except under very extreme circumstances. And it was, you know, a very sad day for all of us who knew Chris Stevens and Sean Smith, and then the two CIA contractors who were also killed that night.
And yet, after all the hearings, thousands of documents submitted and examined, it looks like there's going to be yet another investigation into Benghazi. Do you think that is motivated by political reasons, perhaps directed at you personally, or is there a genuine case for having further exploration into what went wrong?
Well, I won't comment on anyone else's motives, but there has been exhaustive investigation, both an independent investigation that I immediately put into effect, as well as the ongoing congressional investigation. And compare what is happening in our Congress today with what happened after the terrible events of 1983, where in Beirut, Lebanon, our embassy and our Marine barracks were attacked and 258 Americans were killed. Of course, there was an investigation, but it was carried out in a professional manner. And then in the late 90s, two embassies in Africa, in Kenya and Tanzania, were also attacked, 12 Americans killed. There have been 100 attacks on American facilities since 9/11. Every one of them needs to be looked at. We have lessons to be learned, but clearly the amount of attention being paid to this terrible tragedy seems greater than others that have occurred in the past 20-plus years.
You say in your book that, in hindsight, it was a mistake to vote as you did in 2002 to authorize the Iraq War. Looking at that, looking at Afghanistan, looking indeed, as we've just been, at Libya, do you think it's possible to say that the world is, in fact, not a safer place than it was pre-9/11, and a lot of that is due to the American interventions?
No, I don't think that's a fair statement. I think that certainly, as I say in the book, it was a mistake for the Bush administration to go into Iraq and to operate in the way that it did. We can agree and see that now. But I also believe that there was no choice but to go after al-Qaeda and the Taliban who were sheltering him in Afghanistan. And we have given Afghanistan, just as we gave Iraq, the opportunity to try to pull together a unified nation and develop themselves. Unfortunately, in Iraq, the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has, failed to take advantage of what was a great opportunity but instead has carried on in a sectarian, exclusive manner,
right,
alienating the Sunnis in Iraq, who are now making, unfortunately, common cause with the terrorist group ISIS. And we'll see how it plays out in Afghanistan, but there was just an election. Hopefully it will be resolved, and there will be an ongoing commitment to the security of Afghanistan. So I think what's going on in the world is much, much broader and deeper than any intervention by the United States.
And yet you mention ISIS there, and as we speak, literally, security is being tightened on flights bound to the United States or for the US from Europe amidst credible terrorism threats. Isn't it possible to argue that the threat from ISIS far surpasses anything that al-Qaeda might have offered?
Well, not if you're from New York, Sean. Not if you saw those burning towers. Not if you, you know, went down to Ground Zero as I did the day after. Not if you took care of the families of so many of those who lost their loved ones. I think we face ongoing threats and dangers. It's a world in which we're bound together in some ways by technology, but those who wish us ill are in, empowered by technology. And so, yes, is ISIS a new threat? Yes, most likely it is, and that's why we have to remain vigilant, and why, you know, civilized countries have to work together to try to not only deter such a threat, but eventually try to eliminate it.
There are very good reasons, Secretary Clinton, why you would not decide or at least announce a decision about contesting the election in 2016 until at least late this year or early next year. But have you ever told people behind, for instance, the Ready for Hillary campaign that they actually might be disappointed, that they should cool their jets because it mightn't happen?
No, I've had no contact with them. Under our election rules, that would be inappropriate.
They're you could send them a signal.
Well, you know, I'm not going to send anybody a signal, pro or con, because ultimately people are allowed and encouraged to do whatever they desire. I'm the one who has to make the final decision. I have a lot to consider. And, you know, first I'm going to be a grandmother, which I'm looking forward to. And then we have a very consequential set of elections in November of this year that will determine who is going to run our Senate. And I want that to be the focus. I don't think that we need to be jumping ahead 2 years. We need to be focused on what we're doing right now.
But there are lots of hints to people reading your book, especially in the opening and closing chapters, that you are minded to run, that that's what you intend to do, and that's the decision you would like to take. Looking at the quotes, even going back to when you actually had to accept defeat in the race for the Democratic nomination, you said as you prepared the speech, which was a very difficult one, "I felt I had let down so many millions of people, the women and girls who had invested their dreams in me." What do you think those people are going to think and say if you don't contest in 2016?
Well, I'm very honored by the enthusiasm and the energy that people are putting into encouraging me or persuading me to make the decision they want me to make. But that's no way to do this. As I say at the end of the book, you know, the questions are not will you run or can you win? It's what's your vision for the country and can you lead us there? And I think we need to be focused on all of the challenges we face in the United States. We have economic challenges, we have political challenges. Obviously, I care deeply about those, and I think I'm continuing to serve to try to address them, particularly through the work I do with my husband and my daughter at the Clinton Foundation. And at the end of the day, I think I know as much as anyone could about the strains, stresses, demands of being president, having had my husband there for 8 years, having worked closely with President Obama, and actually going through the aftermath of 9/11 with President Bush. So I have no illusions about the difficulties that any president of the United States will face. And I just have to make up my mind about what I think is the best thing for me and the best decision for the country, and that's what I'll do.
A lot of people say we learn more from our defeats than we do from our successes, based on what happened in 2008, and also based on your experience working as Secretary of State. Do you think if you were to stand at this stage, that you'd make a better president in 2016 than you might have after 2008?
Well, that's a great question. I think if a person continues to learn, learning from mistakes, challenging oneself, hopefully you do get better over time. I've had an extraordinary set of experiences as Secretary of State that I think are very important to me, no matter what I do next. And I've also been able to observe and take, you know, take notes of how things are going in my own country. So whatever role I decide that I wish to do or that I'm privileged to fill, I think I will bring even, you know, greater information and experience to it.
Nobody has had a closer ringside seat of two presidents in modern times than you've had. Well, perhaps Dick Cheney might be another candidate for that. But here's the question. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, compare and contrast as presidents and politicians.
Well, I'm proud of both of them. I'm certainly proud of the my husband, the president I have been married to and watched do so many good things for our country, including his deep involvement in working with the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. But I'm also very proud of having served with Barack Obama. I think if you compare the accomplishments of both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama with recent presidents, they rank very high.
And their style, their style of operating as politicians and presidents?
Well, I think they, you know, they're both incredibly effective politicians. There's no doubt about that. But they also are both very smart men and very committed, great senses of responsibility. So I'm privileged because I, as you say, have seen both of them up close and personal as they've made some very hard decisions over the years.
You mentioned Ireland at the start. You might be here this time next year. But seriously, do you keep an eye on events in Northern Ireland? And are you concerned about the drifting apart, as it seems, and it's happening again today, of the two main parties, the DUP led by Peter Robinson, and Sinn Féin?
Well, I do keep a close eye. I care deeply about what happens in Northern Ireland, as does my husband. And he was, you know, recently there just a few months ago. We try to stay in contact. So much has been accomplished, and I know there are still obstacles in the way of trying to achieve all the goals that everyone hopes for. But I certainly pray that you know, everyone keeps their, you know, keeps their eyes on the ultimate goal of trying to make sure people can live in peace and security and reconciliation.
It's all about working together. Would it concern you, for instance, finally, Secretary of State or former Secretary Clinton, that we have party leaders in this jurisdiction in Dublin saying they don't think they should work or they should form governments with Sinn Féin, even if the numbers come right after our next election, which will also be in 2016 if things go to plan? Does that kind of thinking or talk, does that disappoint you?
Well, I'm not going to comment on internal Irish politics. I have enough challenges dealing with American politics. But obviously, in any democracy, people have the right to vote. And once those votes are counted, then I think the responsibility of governing falls on those who have been elected, however they organize themselves.
Hillary Clinton, again, happy Independence Day, and thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you. Good to talk with you, Sean.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.